podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this special edition of Nessun Dorma. It's Lee here. However, this episode is going to be dedicated to the interview that our Gary did with Rob Sloman, the director of the recently released Everton documentary, Howard's Way, which is absolutely brilliant, if you haven't seen it already. It's available on DVD and all good streaming services. It's Gary that does the interview. However, I'm just here to do a bit of an intro. And Gary began by asking Rob how he got started with this whole idea.
The idea itself is quite old because I make films, etc. It was always something that I wanted to do, to make a film about Everton. But with all these sort of projects, you need the finance, and that's always going to be the tricky part. I made a film a few years ago about Seve Ballesteros, the golfer, and he was very much a sporting hero of mine. But it was sort of the finance was put in place by somebody else before I started, and I ended up making a few things about or with Seve, including working on the movie in 2014, the Seve the movie, where I was on the archive side, and that gave me an insight into the raising money process for an independent film. You know, if a film company doesn't back it, where do you get the money? So I know that they were looking for lots of private investment on that film. And then a couple of years ago, I went to one of the film studios, film companies, and was asking lots of questions about the future of sports doc for a completely different project, nothing to do with this. And in that conversation, the chap that I was meeting with suggested that a film about Everton in the 80s might work. Based on the success of I Believe in Miracles and Arsenal's 89, he felt that there was a decent chance because Everton fans hadn't had anything. There had been no films really about Everton, nothing about that team. And it's a massive club with a massive support. And so he thought that commercially it had a chance. So he didn't really need to say any more to me than that. I went home that night and furiously wrote up a treatment. I got something that I'd been sort of playing with for years and years. So I had the sort of bones, and I just sort of spent the next 2 days fleshing that out, and then sent it back. Or I got a proper online treatment put together, and then sent it back to Universal. Well, I better just put film company because I don't want to dump Universal in it, but because they pull out at some point. So I sent it back to the film company. I got a budget done based on what I thought they would want, which was, it was reasonable, but it was sort of low for a film of this type. It wasn't anywhere near the budget that they had on films like Maker's Dream, Gerard Kenny. But it was in line with the budget that they had on I Believe in Miracles, I think. And in the end, that is the inspiration for Everton Howard's Way. It's very different in its type, in the type of film that it is. But the idea of the players talking about the stories of that day, the fun that they had. Obviously, they had Brian Clough as their manager, who's a film on its own, we know that. And Howard was very different. He didn't court the media in quite the same way. It did seem, with the characters that were in that team, it did seem that a film should be possible. And then it was just about getting hold of the players, assessing their interest. And very quickly, it became clear that they were interested. I went to Andy Gray first because I knew him a little bit from where we'd both previously worked at Sky. And Andy then, Andy was very keen. He got me in touch with Peter Reed, Graham Sharp. They were both very keen. Peter Reed, as I've said on lots of occasions, has an amazing context book. He's got a number for everyone.
He had everybody's number when he was playing.
Yes, exactly. Well, very good. Yeah. I didn't sort of say to him, can you give me all these numbers? It was just when I ran into a sort of stumbling block on any player, I just went back to Peter and said, do you have a number for this guy? And invariably he would. He had He had two Kevin Richardsons, although I didn't know that at the time. So he gave me a number for Kevin Richardson, and I phoned him and I left a message, and then we got talking on WhatsApp. And after quite a lot of messages, it became clear that it wasn't the right Kevin Richardson. How he didn't immediately say, "Oh, I'm not the one you want." Why he thought, "I'm making a film about Everton and I would want him because he's a mate of Peter's." I don't know, but anyway, eventually we got to the right Kevin Richardson, and one by one we just picked him off. I think that Gary Stevens was a physio in Australia, so I sort of tracked him down, just good old Google. And Mike Lyons, I knew, was out in Perth because of, you know, the Everton fans, etc., saying, "Oh, Mike's out there doing this." So tracked him down. Trevor is in Dubai most of the time, but got hold of his management and she put me in touch with him. And then who were the other tricky ones? Adrian Heath was tricky because he's in Minnesota, but Reedy gave me his numbers and details. So we got hold of Adrian, and really they were all helpful.
How did you decide on the structure?
So when I was working on the Seve movie, I think their original intention was to do it in the style of Senna, i.e. you don't see the interviewees, you don't see them. Everybody's kept out of it. I there wasn't enough footage to do it in that style anyway. I mean you would need a ridiculous amount of and even if you did have the footage, you'd then have to pay for it, and the budget wouldn't stretch to that. And I don't mind. I think if the interviews look good, then I think they very much add to it. And also with players like this, when they're laughing, when they're telling the stories, I think you want to see them, and you want to see what they look like now anyway. So I don't tend to make any films where I require a narrator, not anymore anyway. Maybe, as you say, maybe many moons ago. But the style of films I like are the ones that are self-narrated by the cast, if you like. And that was always the plan here. And the structure of the story, it sort of evolved over time. I think I originally had it in my head that we'd probably start with them running on at Wogan, and then the more programs that I watched, more people seemed to have seen that clip, and therefore it wouldn't have that surprise factor that you want at the start of a film. It just didn't seem special enough to do it, having seen that, you know, it was on a couple of shows, clip shows, you know, the worst football songs of all time, yeah, and all those sort of things. So and then I was sat down with when I actually got to the point where I thought it was going to happen, I then sort of targeted Twitter to find some real characters from the Everton fan base, because I always felt that it needed a fan element, because I think Everton's a very, very special club for its relationship between players, club, fans. I think it's almost unique in that sense, and maybe that'll change when we go to Bramley Moor, but at that moment it still retains that passion between the players. I'm going to say just about the players. Definitely the fans love their club, Everton. Everton fans love the club in a way that I can't think that many other clubs do. That might seem, you know, may seem a statement you could argue with, but there is that relationship between the club and the fans. They are, if you look at it, and I know it's because we're not so corporate as a lot of them yet, and again that will change, but if you look at the celebration pictures when Everton score a goal, when the players run to the ground, there's no iPads, there's no iPhones, nobody's filming the moment particularly. Most people are in the moment, they're loving it, they're still retaining that sort of frenzied passion, and I wanted to put a little bit of that in the film. And so I was sort of casting my eye over Twitter to see who were the fans that seemed to engage with other guys, and Dave Feely was somebody that I spotted quite early on. Started chatting to him about various things, not really Everton at that time, but once I met him at West Ham, the cup game that we lost on penalties a few years ago. I met him there and I said to him, "I want to make a film. It's a while off yet, but I'd like to do it." And then when we got the sort of green light, I arranged to meet him in Liverpool, And one of the early chats that we had, he told me this story about the Alan Ball story that's at the front of the film.
Yeah.
And suddenly it sort of seemed to make sense to recap a little bit, to just say, listen, this was a club that was very successful, massive history, and the big players came to Everton. There was no bigger player on the market than Alan Ball after the 66 World Cup, not in terms of his age and everything else. You know, he was, and he went to Everton, and I think that gives you a good idea of how big a club Everton was. I think that who'd won the most titles at the mid 60s stage of the mid 60s?
It was about level. I think there was a time when I think Arsenal had seven. Everton had seven.
Yeah. So really and truthfully, I wanted to show that Everton were a massive club with a massive history, and then show where it went a little bit. I knew I'd got Mick Lyons to sort of take me through the 70s, but David's Alan Ball story just was a lovely link, you know, and his idea that, well, you know, we'll never win anything again. And we didn't for a long time. And so that sort of allowed me to then get into the bulk of the story, which was fairly easy then, because, you know, you have a timeline and, you know, sometimes you might be tempted to sort of dart back and forward, but I didn't want to alienate the audience too much. So I did a little bit of that with things like going to the 66 Cup final to introduce the Frank Wilmot, the windmill. But generally speaking, once I'd got that sort of starting 60s, 70s, and here comes Howard, everything seemed to flow then. And one thing I was sort of saw very early on was that Derek Hatton's timeline, and obviously Derek was a massive political figure in the 80s, and he more than anyone, whether it, for good or bad, he was the sort of political face of Liverpool in that same period that Everton and under Howard, his first term, Howard's first term at Everton. So I noticed his timeline, you know, surging to sort of popularity and the height of it with the demonstrations and the protest march and everything, and then he himself falling away under the weight of Kinnock's speech and other stuff, and the timeline was remarkably similar. So, you know, I always thought we have to tell the story of Liverpool, the city. Or we have to touch on it. I don't think I went too deeply into it. In Two Tribes did that really well. The BT documentary, I thought, did a great job of that. And I didn't feel that it was the right vehicle to get too immersed in it. So I wanted to talk to Derek and get a flavour for it, because, you know, you do your research and you find out just how difficult it was in Liverpool in the early 80s and mid 80s, in fact, the 80s, full stop. You know, Keith Mullins said an interesting thing. He said, you know, people think the 80s in Liverpool, they think that the 80s started in 1980, but actually in Liverpool, it started in the late 70s. So, you know, things were on their way down. And,
you could
certainly make a case for it starting decades earlier, but I felt it was right to do a little bit on that. I had loads more archive about the 80s and obviously all of the managed decline material. I had that, but it just felt like I was going too far away if I did that. And Derek was very closely associated with the team. He was very pally with a lot of the players. You see that in the film, that Adrian, you know, he became close to Adrian and Adrian's dad. He's still close to Peter Reid now, I think. So I felt that was right. And then, you know, Liverpool and music, I'm not the first person to link those two, am I? And fashion. It was interesting for me to see some of the pictures that Dave Feely's got, that Keith has got, about how they were sort of wearing their Adidas trainers, 70s, 80s, you know, making a statement that other people all followed, you know, in the years to come. So, I mean, I'm sat here now in a pair of Adidas trainers, you know, and it was just a look that most Liverpool fans will say that they started, Liverpool and Everton fans, with their trips over to Europe So I wanted to get a flavour of everything else that was going on. The music was important, the fashion and the political situation, it was all important.
What's been the reaction of the fans, particularly the hard-to-please ones, maybe like me, who were actually there?
Listen, you can only make the... So you've got a film in your head and you can only really do that, and you have to make the film you want to make. You have to do that. I wanted to make it right for the core. I had a sense that of what would work, because, you know, I've been an Everton fan since I was 6 years old. So I had initially my first 88 to 94 was in newspapers. So editorially, I thought I would be all right. And I know that which were the moments that mattered to me through the different years. But in terms of you can't worry too much is I guess what I'm saying, because I always wanted to make it with humour. The editor that I work with, Mike Brook, and I, we're similar in that sense that if we think something's funny, it'll go in. It was good to hear the reaction. The premiere on the second was obviously, I wouldn't say it was nerve-wracking, because we were confident that we'd got a good film. But you wait for a reaction at the point where you think there should be a reaction. And the reaction came earlier than either of us had expected, and I thought from that point, I thought, well, we'll be okay if they're laughing. Yeah. If they're laughing here. So in terms of getting it right for the core, I thought I had a head start, because, you know, I've lived it haven't lived it in Liverpool. That's the one thing that I was maybe a little bit concerned about, and that's why it was important for me to get fans like Dave Feely, Keith Mullen, Barry Cass was a part of this, Mark Nixon, Crawford Miles, all these guys. I'd sat with them, I'd spoken to them. I wanted to get a feel of what it was like at that time. I don't think anybody expresses it quite as well as Dave Feely. I think he's a remarkable character. But I wanted to have a feel for the away fans, you know, not just the guys that would rock up at Goodison, but the guys that were on the buses, like you're talking about, that would do anything to get into games. I mean, Dave and Keith told me stories of getting into games without tickets, that, you know, being a lad from Cornwall who, you know, didn't get to go to Everton games, and certainly wouldn't have had any understanding of the troubles in Liverpool and the difficulties that were up there, and therefore, you know, it was an eye opener to hear some of the stuff they got up to allow themselves to get into games. And obviously, I've seen the pictures of at Wembley. I think it was 86 where the BBC captured the fans leaping to the window, you know, 40 feet up in the air, you know. So I was aware of the passion and the desire that existed between the various fans up there, that their desperation to make sure they saw a match at all costs. But, you know, some of Dave's stories are hilarious, and I'd heard a few from a chap called Dave Kirby, a Liverpool fan. I'd done a feature about him. He's a writer and he's a poet as well, I think. And he told me some hilarious stuff. So I knew there was things that went on, not much that I could relate to, but it was important to try and get a feeling for it. And I spent a lot of time after matches in the Winslow pub talking to people. And when I was in there, I thought, wow, these people live this. This is really their life, you know. And that was the one area, I guess, I was like, wow, they'll know if it's not authentic. If I come across as a bit of a fraud here, then there's no hiding place. The stories help. When we were going and meeting the players, you know, the stories, and I've read so many books, Gary, that I just thought, right, I've got a good idea for half a dozen, 10 stories, and I'm sure when I sit down with the players, they'll tell me more. And a funny story is a funny story. So that was always going to help me.
I mean, there's a whole extra film about scally culture. You might be the man to make now.
Well, listen, I mean, if I thought that, you know, if That's the problem, Gary. I mean, having a good idea is one thing, but
yeah.
You know, there's loads of films that I want to make that people just say to me, "Well, I don't see commercially how it works," and I'm like, "Oh, yeah."
You might expect some of the players who have made a career in media, the likes of Andy Gray and Trevor Stephen, to speak well, but it was such a delight to see Gary Stevens in Australia there speaking so well, but the one who must have been tricky was Neville Southall, because in a way he's still sort of sat on his own, leaning against the post, isn't he? So what was it like trying to pin him down and trying to get an edit that worked?
I think that Neville knows what he's doing. I think. Yeah. You know. So listen, it became clear. So when we're walking, when we met Neville up in Liverpool, and we were just off to do the filming, and he comes alongside me and he says, "Right, can I swear?" And I said, but infrequent, Neville, is the answer to that. Don't keep doing it. And I don't think he heard a word I said, because he just swore all the way through. But he spoke so well for so long. I mean, Neville, like all the players, he was just incredibly generous with his time. And I think he got into it, and I think he absolutely knows what he's doing. He knows that he's deadpan. Were you at St. George's Hall?
No.
Right, so he goes up on the stage and immediately just starts, you know, completely deadpan delivery, slating everybody else. You know, somebody said, "Neville, you were the world class, you were the world's best." He goes, "Well, I had to be behind this shower of shit," or something like that. Yeah. You know, so he knows what will get a laugh. He knows that if he plays that role, that people lap it up. When there were loads of things that I couldn't put in from Nev, because he just did swear in the middle of it, and I thought I got to be careful here, because I don't want to put too many in. But generally speaking, on the stuff that mattered to me and the way I was making the film, it was all pretty good. So you know, when he was talking about various players, he maybe, you know, just to get a laugh, had put an F or a this or that in there. But I didn't need too much of that. You know, I used, you'll have seen in the film, I used Neville in a certain way. You know, he doesn't break into a smile very often, apart from when you recount the Alan Harper story. He still finds that hilarious. But he was great. And I mean, when you're talking to Neville, you are aware that he is the one guy in that team who could say that he was the world's best in his position. There were loads of really good players in that team, but he was fantastic. So, you know, it was important to get him on side. When I went to meet him, I met everybody, pretty much everybody before we interviewed with them. I went to meet them just to tell them about the project. And I went to Neville down Carmarthen Way in Wales, and we met in a small leisure centre and just sat on a couple of plastic chairs in reception and just chatted about it. And obviously everybody's coming in going, "Blimey, is that Neville Southall?" You know, we had a good chat there. And very quickly you realise what role these people have to play in the film. I knew when we interviewed Pat Van Den Howe, I knew it was Goldust. I don't think it would have been his dream scenario to be doing that. Pat Van Den Howe, but again, generous with his time, and having done that interview, you know, he obviously was okay with it, because I then asked him to do that bit with John Bailey, and Pat, if he was really uncomfortable, would just look at you and say no.
It was absolutely lovely to see it.
I was at the game when
John Bailey scored from the halfway.
Oh yeah, line. Luton, yeah.
Tremendous stuff. And I was also there when he got sent off at QPR. What he didn't mention is that Simon Stainrod was sent off from a prone position.
He was on the deck.
Yeah.
Being sent off by the referee.
It was a good scrap.
He still had it in his eye.
Absolutely. When I met him, Gary, he was looking at me. We met at the Blue Base at the Everton in the Communities Hub.
Yeah.
And we met there, and I was introduced. I think David Feely and Karina Duffy from Everton in the Community, who is outstanding, by the way, in terms of how hard she works and how key she was on this project. So they introduced me to Pat, And for the first 5 or 6 minutes, he didn't say very much. He just looked at me. He was sort of working out whether he was or he wasn't going to get involved in this. And then almost out of nowhere, I mentioned the Bayern Munich game, and it just changed. He sort of softened slightly. And just said, yeah, I still remember the noise. He said it was like a volcano, just went boom. And I said to him, Pat, that's all I really need from you. Yeah. You know, little gems like that would be absolutely perfect. And I didn't know how he was going to react talking about John Bailey when he came in, but he loved it. He loved telling that story. And that's why I'd always had the idea of interviewing them together. But John Bailey didn't turn up for the wasn't able to make the first interview. So I did Pat on his own, and I thought, I still want to do them together. I like the idea of them sitting there telling us how it happened, because I knew they were great mates now. Pat was an interesting character, but you know, was worried about how he came across. And I said to him, this is before we'd done any screening, so only me and a half a dozen other people had seen it, and I said, I honestly wouldn't worry, Pat. I think you come across brilliantly, and I think people will really like you in this. They did. I had a couple of good mates from Sky went to watch it last week. There was a screening at Sony for the industry, industry Evertonians. I thought it was just literally Sony industry connections, but actually they managed to find 50 TV and film people, Evertonians in and around London. Yeah. So they all came for this.
We're like rats.
I know.
In London, you're never more than 6 feet away from an Evertonian.
I think it's brilliant. In fact, one of them's just, there's a guy at the BBC who tweeted overnight about something, and he's arts and entertainment at the BBC. I've gone straight back to him to say, can you review it, please? Because the BBC, we haven't cracked the BBC yet, really. Where was I? I talk so much I tend to put myself off. But
did anything surprise you? Because one of the things that surprised me a great deal is that it had hurt Adrian Heath so much to have missed out on those glorious nights.
You know, you mentioned that bit about Adrian. I'd seen the pictures of him on the pitch at half time and how he'd gone. You know, because you can see it at the end of the film. You can see when he gets his medal, he gets that reception from the crowd.
Yeah.
You know, there was tears in his eyes then. It wasn't a surprise to me that he was emotional about that. I'd read Simon Hart's book, Here We Go. Have you read that?
No, I haven't.
You need to read it. It's very good. Lots of the stories in there. You'll recognise a few of the stories. But I'd read his chapter in that, and I knew he found... that night in particular in Rotterdam, I knew he found that hard. I guess the surprising thing, I've known Andy Gray a long time, and I was really surprised to see him start to go when he talked about leaving the club. And if I wasn't sure whether everybody else would see it on the screen, and obviously it's a big screen, so you do see it, but you know, I thought when I'm talking to him, I thought, oh, he's red-eyed here. I didn't expect Andy, you know, 30-odd years on, I didn't expect it to still upset Andy that he left Everton, and he was genuinely upset. And so you see a lot in just how much they cared. All the players, when I spoke to all of them, you know, the Trevors, the Paul Bracewells, who played at other clubs, you know, for chunks of time, good periods of time, Gary Stevens, I said, what's your club? You know, always asked them, what's your club? And they all said Everton. Everton, you know, Bracewell, who's, you know, not from Liverpool and played a lot of his career away from Everton and was injured a lot of the time at Everton after 86 and Billy Whitehurst. But, you know, Brace is absolutely no doubt he's an Evertonian. And I think that's what the club does to you. I just think it, you know, you spend any time there and it has a sort of magical effect on you. And these guys are lucky that the magical effect was at a time when we were winning stuff. You know, imagine those poor sods who feel themselves a complete Evertonian who had nothing but, you know, misery and disappointment.
I have a 22-year-old son
who probably falls into that category.
Just leave you because we're running out of time.
You've been very generous.
Gary, you
didn't like the overuse, or that you thought it was overused, the tunes, didn't you?
No, it wasn't so much the music at the time. I can take China Crisis or Leave.
No, you meant the FA Cup song.
I felt that
there was a little bit too much.
No, that's all right. I mean, listen. Everybody's got opinion. I read it, and actually, it was quite nice to read it because if you're on Twitter, you see we just hadn't had anything other than positivity. It's been unbelievable. Yeah. So I quite liked it. I read it and I thought, okay, that's interesting. I mean, 84. I don't think anybody remembers that song. So I obviously 84. I thought it was really relevant because I'd asked Feely. I mean, Feely knows everything about Everton dating back to the 19th century. All right, so he is an encyclopedia, and he didn't remember that song. Nobody remembered it. So I thought that was nice to do that. And Here We Go was very important to the end of the film, and I knew that that was my only opportunity to lift it up. I had to lift it up. I needed that. I knew that the players had done that. I knew that they'd got round. I knew it had been filmed. And it felt like, and at St George's Hall, everybody started singing the song when they thought the film was over. It sort of ends in three bits, doesn't it? But they all started, you know, getting into Here We Go. And I thought, okay, but I watched that and or I read your piece and I thought that's interesting. And listen, if I asked 1,000 people and they weren't all Evertonians, they'd all, you know, lots of people would definitely say, I could have done with less Derek Hatton. To me, I weighed that up a million times myself because I know that one or two of the players weren't as close to him as others. And it's a fine balance. Whether there was more of him at one point, and we watched it, and I thought, there's a bit much.
I had heard Degsy run round the houses with those quotes and stories so many times before, but the rest of the film was so very, very fresh.
I totally get what you're saying. I mean, it is almost like an old stand-up going through his routine again. But by the same token, if this film is to work, you know, outside of the fan base, and obviously I need to get it right for its core, but if it's going to stand up so that somebody who's sitting down watching it with an Evertonian clings to it a little bit, then I have to sort of start and end that story. It needs to have a start, middle, and end. But listen, he's a very divisive character in the city now and countrywide. I come from Cornwall. You do your research on what Cornwall was like in the 80s. Yeah. There weren't many farmers.
No.
There weren't many farmers with their thumbs up for Derek Hatton, let me tell you that. Yeah. So I absolutely get that. But once he's in, you have to do it properly, I think. So
my father said to me, probably sometime around the Leicester games, that would be February 85, and he'd been going since the war, that this wasn't just the best Everton side he had ever seen, but the best Everton side that we would ever see. And I think, therefore, I knew from quite a young age, I was 21, that there was something very precious and fragile about this team coming together so quickly. And indeed, they faded quite quickly as well, or rather they disbanded quite quickly as well. And I think your film really is the definitive story of something that was unique, that hadn't really happened before and obviously can now never happen again.
So I probably, the 90% of the film, I sort of cobbled it together. I edited it together so that the timeline worked. But it's the touches. It's the little things that the speed of an edit, you know, when there's conversation going on and you need to cut quickly, etc., to try and give it some life, like Peter Reid's story about joining the club and getting hammered and just bits where there's dialogue pinging around. He's brilliant at that. And it, you know, I noticed that so many of the laughs come from the way that he's edited little bits in the film. And he's my go-to. He's brilliant, Mike Brook. We're releasing some music from the film. Obviously not the commercial stuff. People have said, is there a soundtrack? Well, there is, but it's the original stuff, the stuff that Keith Mullen put together with his team. We're releasing that. So Everton Forever, which is the song that's at the end of the film as the credits go up, that one they'll all be available, but that's the one that we're hoping that Everton supporters enjoy particularly. So we had nearly 2 weeks at FACT for this. So it's been I think we, in the time that it was there, it was the most popular film that they had on. I think that's right. You might need to go to them and check that, but I believe that of all the films that they had during the period that Everton Howard's Way was there, we were their top selling film. But I'd like to get it back between now and Christmas, get another week somewhere if we can. I don't know how possible that is. We're looking to get a screening in London as well. And then festival wise, I sort of defer to the people behind the scenes on that one, on where we can take it and what we can do. But so we'll try and there are people with more experience in terms of festivals and et cetera than me, but I would imagine that we'll take it wherever we can. Yeah.
So thank you very much and congratulations on a tremendous achievement, a fine film for obviously every Evertonian, but also anyone with an interest in the culture of the UK in that stormy decade of the 80s.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.